Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 5:10 p.m. on Thursday, March 31st, 2016. Present, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, myself, Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Pruitt, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Edgman, Representative Munoz, Vice Chair Sadler. Co-Chair Newman is in another meeting, and we'll probably be joined shortly by Representative Gaddis. All right. With that, please make sure your cell phones are turned off. We don't want those ringing in here. It'll cost you $20 for Boys and Girls Club in Juneau. We will continue hearing House Bill 247.
And donuts.
And donuts. And donuts.
Here to continue speaking to the bill is Mr. Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division. We'll also hear from Department of Natural Resources today, Division of Oil and Gas, and we have Commissioner Randy Hoffback to come up to the table with Ken Alper. And I think that we were on page 44 of your presentation, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before Ken Alper, the Director of the Tax Division for Revenue, if anyone had questions on the fiscal note pieces that were on the last three or four slides before I get to 44, it might be helpful, but that's at your pleasure.
Yeah, Mr. Alper, some of the committee members are still, pardon? Some of the committee members are, some of the committee members are still confused about what we went through very rapidly earlier this afternoon, and I wanted to make sure that all the committee members understand that Mr. Alper is available to come and personally sit down with you and go through anything that you don't understand. Is that right, Mr. Alper? Mr. Alper, is that good for
yes,
you?
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Okay. You all have my cell phone number.
All right, you have to place your, we're starting a new meeting, yes. So place yourselves on the record again and go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue.
And I'm Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
So I will skip past these fiscal note pieces. The next section where we left off at this afternoon's hearing was the snapshots of the new scenario analysis model here. I'm on slide 45, and this is a project life cycle model that we developed over the previous interim and really brought into its full flower for this bill project. And what we've done in the past when modeling tax changes and credit changes, the tendency has been to look across the North Slope like it's one thing, and that doesn't really capture the individual flavor of an actual project and how a change might affect an investor or a specific thing. So instead, we looked at the cash flow for the 30 to 40 year life cycle of a specific project. For in the early years, there's a lot of capital spending. If there's credits earned against that capital spending. In the future years, there's a production curve that goes up, it peaks, it comes down, and over that production, there's certain expectations for what the costs for the company are going to be, the taxes, the royalties they'll pay, what their profits will be, that their taxes and the like. And so what's the state's cash flow and the producer's cash flow? We looked at different scenarios for $40, $60, and $80 oil. If I was sitting here 5 years ago, it probably would have been 80, 100, and 120. And then we also looked at the fall forecast. We haven't updated a lot of these modeling runs to the spring forecast yet. And what we originally did, and we made some long presentations on this topic to the prior committee, was the status quo versus the governor's original bill, House Bill 247 original, the A version. There's two full presentations on basis from the previous committee. I can make fresh copies available to your staff if necessary. And in this model, these are the different scenarios we looked at on slide 50. A 50 million barrel North Slope oil field, this is analogous to the sort of smaller, newer projects that we've seen in 10 years ago at Ugarook or Nikaichuk, or what Brooks Range Petroleum is working on, or some of the smaller type fields that you see in and among the big older fields in the North Slope. And what do their economics look like? Also, we did a much larger field, 750 million barrels of oil in place. That is something more similar to what Armstrong and Repsol have been talking around the building, what they've discovered and think that they could produce. That's a field that would be a much larger project, peaking out at about 120,000 barrels a day at the peak of production. Finally, on Cook Inlet, we looked at the smaller type oil field. No one's anticipating any elephant oil fields in Cook Inlet, of course, but that's very similar to, say, Bluecrest Oil is going to be starting up their development drilling on this year is comparable to what that scenario is. And once again, these are not based on anyone's individual economics. These are stylized projects looking at what we perceive to be the typical and expected economics of a project in those parts of the state. After we presented that to the Resources Committee, they asked for some follow-up scenarios, supplemental scenarios, and we went back and we ran additional runs for that $750 million field in a high royalty scenario. If you're familiar with how the gross value reduction, the new oil provision of Senate Bill 21 works, it's a 20% tax reduction under normal circumstances if, in fact, the field in question is a very high royalty field where all the leases are greater than 12.5%, they get a 30% gross value reduction. So we modeled that type of scenario, basically more royalty money, less production tax money. We also modeled a field where half of it was on private land. There's another document in the committee's packet that lays out how the royalty sharing works in different areas of the state. You know, we get the production tax anywhere in Alaska. That's our right as the state government, as the sovereign. The royalty that we collect is very specific to us being the landowner, to we being the state of Alaska, and it being on state of Alaska land. We've been fortunate that 50, 60 years ago, we had some really good and forethoughtful geologists on the payroll who selected the central north slope at statehood. So the Prudhoe Bay happens to be on state land, and we've collected all those royalties, or we'd be in a very different situation right now. However, NPRA is not state land. ANWR, if and when it develops, isn't state land. There's a lot of private land out there. So the royalty sharing arrangements with the federal government are different from different areas of the state, and we have provided a little bit of a mini model for members to play with that show how much revenue we'd get given different scenarios. But anyway, we did a modeling run for what happens if that big North Slope field was half state and half private royalty. And by the way, on the private royalty, we don't get it. Like, with the federal government, they'll share it with us. We have an arrangement. On NPRA, we'd get half of their royalty. If we say private, we're mostly talking about Native Corporation land. If there's an oil development on Native Corporation land, they do not have any obligation to share any of their royalty with the state. We do, however, have a tax on that royalty. That tax is 5% of their gross royalty. Works out. In a 12.5% royalty, we'd get the equivalent of 0.6% as a tax on that royalty. So modeling, if we get half the royalty, and then if the royalty was 12.5% and whatever that royalty dollar was, we are collecting a 5% tax on that royalty dollar, effectively the state's revenue would be 5% of the 12.5%, which is a little bit over 0.6%. We also modeled a couple of gas fields, a gas field in Cook Inlet and a gas field in Middle Earth. There's no great magic to that 670 billion cubic feet. That is I think that's because it peaked out at something like 50 million feet per day or something like that. It just worked out what the life cycle numbers were. So the slides look like this. They're big and complicated, and there's several hundred of them. I only put a couple of them in this packet. This is the status quo analysis of a North Slope small oil field, 50 million barrels at $60 oil, with the assumption of $60 oil. So if you look at the upper left of this, that is what the production tax cash flow looks like. So you can see 5 or 6 years of development of construction where the companies are spending money, and as they spend money, they are eligible for tax credits from the state. On the North Slope in this day, in this paradigm, they're getting a 35% operating loss credit. So you can see numbers that peak down a little bit below $50 million, below the line. Those are the big red bars. That means that, roughly speaking, they're spending maybe $125 million a year developing their field and earning a 35% operating loss credit. Meanwhile, they start producing in year 5 or 6, and we see those blue bars above the line, and that's what our production tax looks like. The production tax doesn't look so good. But if you go to the upper right, that's all of the state revenue. So the green bars below the line are the same as the red bars in the upper left-hand box. The green bars above the line, likewise, are our production tax. The big addition to the mix is the blue bars, which are the state's royalty. We're getting a lot of money from the royalty. And then also smaller amounts of revenue. There you could see a tiny red wedge and a purple bar. They represent the property tax and the state corporate income tax. And then likewise, in the lower left-hand corner, you could see the same relationship from the point of view of the producer, the money they're spending while they're developing the field, and then the after-tax cash flow that they get after the field is in development. Excuse me. So taking those three data sets for each one of these scenarios, the box in the lower right-hand corner does some summary information. So you can see the first set of numbers relates to just the production tax. That field, we estimate the state will pay out $162 million worth of tax credits before it's functioning. Against that, we'll receive $183 million in production taxes, net gain to the state of $21 million. But we're also applying a discount rate, a net present value. This reflects the time value of money that the state's a dollar to the state is worth less tomorrow than it is today. And the number we use throughout this analysis is the number that was the permanent fund's expected rate of return as of 6 months ago when we started this modeling project, which at the time was 6.15%. So to a certain extent, that is a number we've chosen because it reflects the state's opportunity cost on its money. If we're spending money, we're likely spending it out of savings, which means we have less money in savings. That money would be earning money for us at a certain rate. If we get paid later, that money, we should at least get what we would have earned had we kept the money in our own pockets for the intervening years. If you assign that 6.15% discount rate to the production tax only, the state loses $37 million on the project. To be fair, that's just the production tax. When you build in all of the state's revenue, including the royalty, it looks a lot better. The total state losses are $121 million. That's less than the $162. The reason for that is, if you'll notice in the upper right, they're about starting in about year four, you see some blue bars above the line while the green bars are still below the line. That represents the companies are still getting tax credits in their early years of production because they're still spending and building out their field, but they are starting to produce, so they're paying royalties. So the state's cash flow gets a little better in those years because we're only partially our credits are partially offset by the royalties are coming in. Meanwhile, the state gets $501 million of lifetime cash flow out of this field, or a net gain of $380 million. And if you assign the discount rate, the 6.15%, the state earns $136 million in value, for all intents and purposes, from that field. The bottom set of numbers there is from the producer's point of view. Their cash out is $327 million. Their positive cash flow once they start producing is $731 million. So that's $404 million. If you gave them the same discount rate that you assigned the state, what's that really worth to them? That field is worth $112 million to the producer in this scenario. And we ran a lot of these different scenarios. Once again, this is at different price points. This is $60 oil, which is frankly somewhat challenged. Almost all of the $40 scenarios lost money. You know, we reached the realization that no one's going to be sanctioning any substantial projects in Alaska at $40 oil because they don't make money, not for the state and not for the producer. At $60 oil, we're a little bit closer to break even, and things look a lot more robust at $80 oil. So this is the $60 before. The next slide, slide number 47, is the same set of data, only House Bill 247 as originally introduced. Now that was...
Robert, do you mind if we ask some questions as we go through these slides? They're kind of hard to come back to.
Mr. Chairman, is that your pleasure? These slides come in pairs, if you know what I mean. This is the before, and then the one right after it is the after. If we'd like to get some basic understanding of what's in the before, now would be a good time.
My question through the chair would I hope inform that. I just want to make sure I understand. We talk about what is the timeline here, the first bar, first year. Is that first oil in? Is that when the lease is issued? What's the time horizons we're talking about here?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's when they would start spending money on the project. So with the small number below the line, I don't know if that's a sort of pre-development work, mobilization. The fact that they would be receiving a credit in the neighborhood of $3 or $4 million meant in year one they probably spent $10 million getting ready for a major construction project in year two.
But through the chair,
Representative Sadler.
But that's exclusive of the lease payment, the bonus payments, and so forth. This is when they actually begin to.
Right.
I guess for tax purposes when the project begins.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's correct. The upper left box in particular is unique to just the production tax system, both taxes and credits. Mm-hmm. We did not capture the lease bonus payment aspect, which tends to be a fairly variable number in the full state cash flow analysis.
And I'll hold the other questions. Thanks.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think what's really hard for most of us, even though we were here for SB 21, is to calculate the gross revenue exclusion for the bigger fields and the gross value reduction for the smaller fields. It's easier to understand in terms of effective tax rate after all that stuff is done. In that top left-hand corner for that field at $60 a barrel, is that a gross value reduction field or is that a non-gross value reduction field?
Through the chair, Representative Gareth, thank you for asking the question. It's an important question, and I should have clarified that up front. This is a gross value reduction field. The assumption in all of these modelings are if it's a new field on the North Slope where the GVR is the law of the land, it would almost certainly qualify for the GVR because that's designed to benefit new fields.
Through the chair.
Representative Gareth.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Alperet, I have a report from the department that said for production taxes on gross value reduction fields, the post-2002 fields, right, that we don't really ever see any production tax until about $73 a barrel, unless I misread that. But this at $60 a barrel, you do get some production tax in the out years. So how, what am I not understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I don't have the answer to that question off the top of my head. I need to get back to you with that one. I mean, those are not tremendous numbers for a tax for a whole oil field over the course of a year, $10 to $20 million, but they are positive numbers, and I need to figure out the difference between that. And I'm aware of the analysis we did for you several months ago that said the break even of a new field, given the gross value reduction, is around $70 oil. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stickle, who helped generate this model, is behind me. He might be able to shed some light on this one.
Come right up. Place yourself on the record. While he's coming up, actually, I should have started with oil and gas because they are on the phone. And so what I'm going to do is let us go through probably without any more questions until page 55 of the presentation, go to oil and gas and that DNR, and then come back to Mr. Alper and Mr. Hoffbeck, if that's all right with committee, so we can not have the people hanging on phone all night, because we might be here for a long time. Go right ahead and place yourself on the record.
Chair, for the record, Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue.
Hold the mic down a little bit.
Sure. Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. And to the question of comparing the scenario in slide 47 to the analysis that we've previously provided to the committee, the analysis that we provided was looking at all gross value reduction eligible fields on the North Slope in the aggregate. And that includes a mix of companies that are operating as well as investing in capital expenditures. What you see in this slide here is we've set up a development scenario where most of the capital expenditures take place right up front, and then that's followed by a period of time where you're primarily spending only operating expenditures. So just by the way that we've structured the profile of spend in this scenario, the break even comes down a little bit from that mid-70s level.
Representative Guerra?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I understand, but I don't want to hold people.
Mr. Chairman, let me try to now that I understand what Mr. Stickle just said, let me try to rephrase it, and maybe Representative Guerra will understand. If the rest of you as well, please don't take that the wrong way, anyone. This is a single field, and it's very specific to a field where the spending is sort of front loaded. If we were to take the oil field and spread the capital spending over all the years evenly over the 30 years of the field, there would be some capital spending in years 10, 11, 12, 13 out there that would be enough to offset that taxes and drive it down to zero. So when you're doing an aggregate analysis of a lot of different fields that are at different stages of their life cycle, somebody's capital spending is always offsetting the other guy's taxes. Whereas in this one, because it's only the one field and all the capital's up front, you're seeing it as you're not seeing any capital offsetting the earnings for those later years, so they're paying taxes at a lower oil price.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the understanding that I mean, the report from before was that for the gross value reduction fields, you didn't really get past a zero production tax till you got to about $73 a barrel. So that averages out the early spending and then the later revenue. So negative return for the state in the beginning, positive return later, and then for the average field, you're at over the life of the field a zero production tax. Is that what you mean?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, more or less, in that analysis, there's multiple fields at multiple stages of their life cycle. So some of those fields have a lot of capital spending, which is, if they were taken together, would more than offset the taxes from those who were paying taxes.
Thanks.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at your pleasure, I'm happy to sit down and let DNR do their thing. Looking at slide number 47, I think it's important to look at slide 48. Slide 47 and slide 48 are the same exact field, only instead of the status quo, we are now putting in the changes proposed in the original version of House Bill 247. So in the context of the North Slope, that really means the per company cap of $25 million. That's by far the most substantial change to the economics in these projects. So what that does is, if you look at the first slide where we had credits that were as high as $50 or $60 million, in the second slide they don't go below $25 million, but they get the credits for more years. There's a little bit of a delay in the receipt of some of those credits, and that inevitably is going to change the economics of the project. So look, the state's credit spend is down a little bit from 121 to 101 million, although over a couple more years. The state's production tax paid is a little bit more, and the discounted value of the state's production tax moves a little bit from minus 37 to minus 10. Meanwhile, the total state take goes from a total discounted state value of $136 million to $163 million. So that set of delays has essentially produced about $27 million worth of incremental value for the state. And from the point of view of the producers, it's taken about $20 million in value out of them because their cash in of $746 offsetting their cash out of $362. You know, their cash flow is pushed back a couple of years in some degree, so the discounted cash flow to them is $93 million versus the $112 million that we saw in the so-called before scenario. So we looked at these and said, all right, the changes proposed in this bill are not a dramatic impact on the smaller developers. That $25 million might be a good number, and we can, but meanwhile, we could save the state a little bit of cash flow at that level. What we found, however, was we looked at a larger field. Now, this is the field that was analogous with the Armstrong field that we created, the field that peaks out at a roughly 120,000 barrels a day. And we did it at $80 oil because our feeling is that at this price point, you need to get to this kind of price point before someone's going to make this is literally a $10 billion investment, let's be clear. So when people look at what they're going to spend on a new oil field, it's in terms of capital expenditures per dollar, per barrel in the field in place, barrel of oil in place, or barrel of oil they're going to produce. So if this is going to produce 750 million barrels, and we estimate it's about $13 a barrel worth of capital expenditures, that's just a hair less than $10 billion worth of capital spending is going to be brought to bear in the North Slope to produce this field, which is itself a great thing. We all want that to happen. We would love someone to go to the North Slope and invest $10 billion in a major new oil field that's going to put 100,000 barrels in the pipeline. But it's important for the committee to understand what's the state's commitment to that under a status quo law. And it's actually quite remarkable. And if you look, once spending starts being made in the range of $1 billion or more per year, the state's going to be spending many hundreds of millions of dollars every year in refundable tax credits. That's just the way it works with a 35% operating loss credit. And the bottom of that line there in the upper left-hand red actually reaches a bit over $800 million per year in the peak year of construction for that project. So meanwhile, you go to the right-hand side. All that oil is being produced, the state's getting over $1 billion a year in revenue for a few years there at the peak. That's a wonderful thing, too. We want that revenue. We want that money. But well, we'll get to the summary information. And the company themselves, of course, they've got great cash flow out of this as well. Now, this is, let's not forget, $80 oil. You need $80 oil to get the state their $1 billion a year, too, but that's what we're hoping for. We certainly hope that oil prices get back up there. And this is a 40-year time cycle, so there's a lot of history in front of us before we get to this. So you look at the first line in the lower right-hand corner to say production tax credits cashed is $2.8 billion. That's the actual amount of tax credits that we will be paying out before they start getting to a positive position on the production tax. Meanwhile, we will get almost $9 billion in production taxes over the life of the project and $6 billion net cash flow and $869 million in discounted value. Even more importantly, the state cash flow, when offset by the royalties during those early years of production, were really out of pocket about $2.5 billion. That's the number we should have in our head. This is going to cost the state about $2.5 billion before we get to positive cash flow. And then we're going to get $16 billion in the door, and we'll have $14 billion in state profits. If you discount that over time, we have $3.5 billion in value created for the state and the state's coffers through the life cycle of this project. If we can outlast the capital spending on the upfront, the credit spending on the upfront. From the producer's point of view, they're out of pocket. It's $5.2 billion. That's basically their full capital spend minus the credits they're getting back. They've got $9 billion in positive cash flow once they're producing, and a net gain of over $12 billion to the company and $2.25 billion in discounted cash flow. This is a great project. But then we put in the changes proposed by the bill, and this is where we discovered that the $25 million cap was a more dramatic impact on a very large field than we originally noticed. Because a couple of things start to happen. First off is the $25 million cap on spending greatly reduces the state's cash outlay, and they have all of this carry-forward credit. Once they start producing, those built-up carried-forwards credits are completely wiping out their production tax, and then eventually, because we also built in a 10-year sunset on the operating loss credits, they actually start to disappear. The companies start to lose some of those operating loss credits carried forward. So you see a very dramatic impact on the underlying economics. The most obvious one is total production tax cashed, credits cashed, goes from $2.8 billion to $109 million. And the state's production tax discounted cash flow is $1.7 billion, about double what it was under the before scenario. Likewise, the state's all-in revenue goes from $3.5 billion to $4.4 billion discounted. But we took about a third of the value away from the company. Their discounted cash flow of their project goes from $2.2 billion to $1.4 billion. Now, this is a little bit overstated for the main reason that no single company is probably going to come up here and spend $10 billion. If they and any company that sanctions a project like that is likely to come up with three or four partners, and if four partners were to develop this project together, using the governor's bill as the underlying system, that would actually be $100 million a year in credits because each of them would be eligible to get the 25, and that would change the economics somewhat. But so this, what we learned from this was, whereas the $25 million might work for a smaller field, we probably need to find a way to scale that up a little bit for the larger field. So that
Guttenberg, I'm trying to get through to page 55, okay. And then we'll come back after oil and gas is up. Is that all right? Make a note so we can come back. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, so I didn't put any more scenarios in this graphical form in front of the committee. What I did do, though, was take the summary pages from all of the scenarios and put them in these back few pages of the presentation. So slide 51 is all of the North Slope scenarios. And if you kind of work your way from the top to the bottom, you've got the 50 million barrel field, status quo 50 million, 247. And if you look at the second row in each of the two chunks, the $60 scenario, those are the two slides that I had before the committee a few minutes ago. The small field status quo 60, the small field SB 247 60. And if you go all the way to the right-hand side, the producer's discounted cash flow, you can see where I had that number, $112 million for the company, being reduced to $93 million to the company. I'm on the right-hand side. I wish I had a pointer in here, Mr. Chairman. all the way on the right-hand side, the second row down in the first little group, 112, and the second row down in the second little group, the 93. If someone's about to bring me a pointer, I'm going to pause for a moment.
We've got one right there.
Oh, that might be too high tech for me. Oh, okay, even better.
Okay,
there, this 112 right here, Mr. Chairman, this 93. So if we go back to the first two scenarios I did, the 50 million barrel, this is the 112, the producer's discounted cash flow. This is the state's 162 million out, and then the so-called after scenario, the state's out 101, and the producers have value of 93. So those are the same scenarios that we see on this slide here, the second row, the $60 oil, and the $60 oil for, the $60 oil here and the $60 oil here. Meanwhile, here is the 750 million barrel field. I showed you the slides of this at the $80. That's this row here, the state's credits. Now, the state's credit number doesn't change that much with the price of oil. You could see that. It's really tied to the company's spending because the spending is mostly before there's any production. The cash flow, the production tax, and the state's all taxes are quite substantial depending on the price of oil, and then the value to the producer. And you could see this. None of these projects make any money at $40, and that was what we showed before. So the other thing, so there's this field at 80, then there's the field with House Bill 247 at 80. There's a second series, and I spoke to it briefly before. The governor's original bill had two levels of credit cap, the $25 million per company in general, but if the company in question is large enough that they had more than $10 billion in revenue in the prior year, they're considered large enough to not need state cash support, and they would be getting zero. So we modeled those two scenarios separately. What would it be if it were a smaller company getting $25 million versus a larger company that would get zero? And a field this size, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, honestly, between the $25 million and the zero, because $25 million was such a dramatic impact. So these are the summary of, and this slide presentation was given to House Resources around February 25th or so, and I can get copies of it. This is the last slides of it that shows the summary of those scenarios. The Cook Inlet scenarios, and I didn't bring any to the committee as an example, but you can see the status quo and then the House Bill 247 scenarios. The problem in Cook Inlet is there is this impending moment in 2022 when the tax caps, these statutory zero taxes, go away, and then we have a fork in the road. And for the sake of modeling, we created two different options. Option A was they are going to sunset, and we're going to revert to the base tax in Cook Inlet, which is a 35% tax without any per barrel credit or any gross value reduction. That's probably a tax that most would consider too high. The alternate was the tax caps don't sunset and the future legislature chooses to maintain a zero tax in Cook Inlet. Frankly, that's a tax that's too low. So the real answer is somewhere between these two scenarios. We just don't know what that answer is yet. But looking at, say, an $80 small oil field in Cook Inlet, you could see where the state would be paying $329 million. And if the bill passes, we'd be bringing that down to around $100 million. And basically saving a little bit of value to the state and taking a comparable amount of value from the producers. And there are the colorful graphs to explain all of these scenarios. The Resources Committee asked follow-up questions about new scenarios, and those are summarized in slides 53 and 54. Those are this is the large field again, the 750 million field, only with a 16 2/3% royalty rather than a 12.5% royalty. So the state's revenue gets to be higher, but with the 30% GVR, our production tax comes in lower. The needle didn't move that much, honestly, between the two because they more or less offset each other. This option assumes that it's state land and all the royalty goes to the state. Meanwhile, the second parallel scenario here is the large field paid with the 12.5% royalty, and the state only gets half the royalty, and the other half would go to a private royalty holder who would pay that small 5% tax that I described earlier. Finally, we did modeling for Cook Inlet and Middle Earth gas fields at $4, $6, and $8 per 1,000 cubic feet, how they pencil out and how they're impacted by the bill. And we found for the most part for the smaller fields that the $25 million cap didn't have that dramatic an impact, with the caveat that I mentioned earlier. This assumes that they can develop and sell their gas. If there's a market constraint, that's a game changer, obviously, and something we need to be alert to. And that gets us to 55, Mr. Chairman. So unless this question is on what I just went through, I'm prepared to sit down for a while.
Well, I'm going to let you sit down for a little while, and I'm asking you to stick around so we can come back to you. And we'll go to where I was supposed to have gone in the first place. Okay, here we're going to have Division of Oil and Gas. And here to present from the Department of Natural Resources is Ms. Corey Feige, that's Division of Oil and Director of Oil and Gas. She's online, and we have Paul Decker, Petroleum Geologist 1, the Division of Oil and Gas. He was here. Mr. Decker, Ms. Feige, please place yourselves on the record, and we'll hear your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Decker, and I am petroleum geologist with the Division of Oil and Gas. Director Feige's on the phone.
Director Feige?
Mr. Chair, I believe her intention was to answer questions if they came up, so.
Okay, you want to go ahead, Mr.
I'm ready to proceed. So I'll do my best to get through this in 45 minutes, get everyone out on time. Thanks for fitting us in.
We're going to stay as long as we have to, Mr. Decker.
Very
right
good.
Ahead.
So,
you want questions held to the end, or do you want to have them as we go through?
It's certainly up to you. So,
we'll see how it goes.
Very well. So, the overview of the presentation here is really it's just broken up into the North Slope, the Cook Inlet, and the Frontier Basins. And our goal here is to just provide an overview and activity update today. So. It certainly has a bearing on the tax credit issues. So look at North Slope first, Cook Inlet, and then Frontier Basins. Look at the resources and reserves in each area, something about the current activity and new things that are poised to come online soon. Look at the list of who's working those various areas. And finally, some of our recent lease sale activity. So this is an overview map of the North Slope. I'm on slide 3. Just for reference, this area shown in this map is about 500 miles from west to east. So it's an enormous area. The area you see there described as NPRA is almost exactly the same size as the state of Indiana, for reference. So I think it brings out a lot of the ownership things that Mr. Alper spoke of. Just to remind everyone, the blue areas off to the north in the Arctic Ocean there, the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea, once you get beyond 3 miles, that is federal offshore continental shelf or outer continental shelf managed by BOEM. To the south, those green areas are, you know, permanently protected federal lands, national parks, national monuments, the Anwar Wildlife Refuge. I mentioned NPRA. That is also federal. It's BLM administered. It's the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And the Anwar 1002 area on the right is not necessarily permanently protected yet, although it could become that way through an act of Congress, or it could become open for leasing, as Ken Alper mentioned. But
are we taking questions, or are we waiting until the end?
Oh, we can start taking questions unless we run out. Representative Guttenberg, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've worked offshore, so I know a little bit about, just a little bit about it. But you said we have a 3 mile limit before it gets into federal land. But the shelf is much farther out than that.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. Yes, the shelf extends much, much farther. But the state ownership only extends from the shoreline to 3 miles out.
So regardless of where the shelf is, it's 3 miles.
You're thinking of the edge of the shelf,
right?
It becomes getting deeper much rapidly. Yeah. Much more rapidly. That is quite a ways further out.
So is that from mean high water mark or? That's okay. It doesn't.
Yeah. So basically, from 0 to 3 miles offshore, we're looking at state mineral rights. Beyond that, it's what they call the outer continental shelf, and that is federal. So the only other areas that I didn't speak of are the central North Slope state lands, and our three area-wide lease sales. They're outlined in a red line here. First, let's see if I can point using the hand here. This area here in the center is the North Slope onshore lease sale. Just in this ribbon of state waters out here, we have the Beaufort Sea lease sale. And then down here in the south, we have the Foothills area-wide lease sale. And it's notable that there's a lot of private ownership within the Foothills. That's Arctic Slope Regional Corporation lands encompassed by our Foothills lease sale. The main oil fields are shown in green, so you notice most of those are strung along the central north slope near the shoreline, and that's because of the underlying Barrow Arch, a massive subsurface feature that helps focus the oil and gas accumulations in that area. There are a number of oil and gas fields along the coastline there. There are mostly gas fields once you get down here into the foothills. And finally, one other thing to appreciate, all those black dots are the 600 or so exploration wells that have been drilled to date on the North Slope. There are many, many thousands of wells inside the green oil fields, but the exploration, you can see that it's not nearly so dense. There's a lot of running room here for still discoveries to come.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, can you go back to that? Sure. So I looked at this one earlier. This is kind of an interesting map. And not being, of course, in your position with the history, I just want to make sure I fully understand. Of course, the green and the red areas, I'm assuming that doesn't mean, like, for instance, the green there, that I'm assuming that's not just Prudhoe or Kuparuk or the ones that we're producing from. Does that include also ones that we know about but we may not be producing from?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that is correct. There are a few non-producing fields that are shown in green here. A couple of notable examples are these just offshore in the eastern Beaufort. That's Hammerhead and Kuvlum. But for the most part, the ones shown in green are actively producing now. Okay. And there would be additional new fields that have not yet come online, in particular discoveries in the PICA unit that have been announced. And if you can see my pointer here, in that general area, basically between Kuparuk and the Koval River unit Alpine field. So in this area, we're now looking at discoveries that have been announced but not yet on production.
Okay. And just
Representative Pruitt.
Follow up on that. Okay, good. So there might be some additional green on the map. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Through the chair, certainly if those projects become sanctioned and go to development, they would be good to add to this map when we have outlines for them. Yeah.
Yeah, and then one follow up to that. Are there other areas that we know that there's resource there, and maybe it's because there's seismic data or there's something that tells us there's probably resource there that we don't have on the map?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, very few examples like that. So what we're really trying to show here is things that have been discovered by the drill bit.
Okay, perfect.
And that is really, I think, the most prudent course of action. Until it's discovered with the drill bit, it's still very speculative. Perfect. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue, Mr. Decker.
Thank you, sir. So just moving on, we're looking at mean estimates in this table here of what the federal government would estimate for undiscovered, technically recoverable, conventional oil and gas resources in the Arctic-Alaska region. So by that undiscovered, we're getting back to Representative Pruitt's question. We're not counting things that have been discovered yet, and we're not necessarily indicating that all of these volumes would be commercially recoverable either. It's really just a question of would these exist in accumulations that could be recoverable given the technology in current practice today. And those numbers boil down to basically 40 billion barrels of oil and about 207 trillion cubic feet of gas. The gas, if you look at the lower right, the gas is roughly equally distributed between offshore OCS waters and the onshore state lands and waters at around 100 trillion cubic feet in each area. For the mean oil estimate, there is assessed to be more oil in the offshore than we have onshore, 23.75 versus 15.9 billion barrels in that case. So these are federal estimates from the USGS and BOEM. Now, if we start thinking about how much has been discovered and is commercial to produce, that's when we can begin to use the term reserves, not until it's commercial to produce. So for gas reserves, we have roughly 30 trillion cubic feet of associated gas estimated to be recoverable from producing or developing North Slope fields, which are mostly Prudhoe and Point Thompson. This is the feedstock for the AKLNG project as envisioned. However, since we don't yet have that pipeline in place, it's not technically accurate to call that reserves, and I think the producers would embrace the use of the term contingent resource, not reserves, contingent on development of a pipeline there to bring that to market and make it therefore commercial. Of that 30 trillion cubic feet, about just under 6 trillion cubic feet is believed to be proved gas reserves. And that's from the Federal Energy Information Administration. So that's the subset of the gas that's present in those fields that would go to things like making natural gas liquids that can be sold through TAPS, minor gas sales, MI, things like that, just with a very local market. On the oil side, the EIA estimates about 2.8 billion barrels of proved oil reserves on the North Slope remaining. That's a very difficult number to come by because there are so many commercial assumptions built in, but this is the federal estimate that I'm reporting here. So now moving on to who's working the area and what are they doing. This list is just in alphabetical order, not necessarily greatest impact or anything like that. So starting in the A's, Accumulate Energy is an Australian firm that has raised money and joined with a leaseholder named Burgundy Exploration, and they've consolidated their efforts into exploring just south of Prudhoe Bay in the Franklin Bluffs area for shale oil resources. And they did drill the Icewine number one well last fall. They seem encouraged from what they've said publicly, but it's certainly, there's a lot of uncertainty there about whether that will move forward. They are conducting seismic exploration of their lease area, which is a substantial block of leases this winter, and so we'll see where they go with that. The exploration affiliate of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, AEX, is working this winter and spring in the Placer unit. That's just adjacent to the Kuparuk River field. So they spud their well that they needed to evaluate that unit in late January. Moving on, BP, the operator of the Prudhoe Bay unit. As you know, Prudhoe Bay continues to go at a really rapid pace of activity there. They completed 8 new grassroots wells, in other words, drilling from surface, 46 new sidetracks, and conducted about 420 well workovers in the initial participating area there. That's the main Prudhoe oil pool in 2015. They also completed the first wells in the Lisburn carbonate reservoir in 9 years. They did that last year, and also last year they completed a large partially onshore, partially offshore 3D seismic program, the North Prudhoe survey. Moving on to Kalis. Kalis bought Pioneer's assets in Alaska, so that was mostly the Uguruk unit at the time. They've continued ongoing development there in their Nuiqsut PA, I believe. 4 to 5 wells a year. All of these wells are long reach horizontals with fracks in order to tap the better to tap the not so great reservoir potential and get those wells to flow at commercial rates.
For the information of the committee, PAs and
Yes, sorry for the jargon there, Mr. Chairman. PA stands for participating area. So that is the subset of the leases within a unit that are actually actively contributing to production.
And you had one other acronym.
MI.
Yeah.
MI, I'm sorry, yeah, MI would be miscible injectant. So that would be for enhanced oil recovery purposes.
Thank you.
You are.
Thank you for that opportunity to clarify. So the NUNA project at the Uguruk unit is a new one that Kalis wants to bring on. They've slowed that down a little bit with the slump in oil prices. Now that looks like the startup there, the first oil, would be late 2018. That's from another one of these relatively tight formations. These are sands in the Torok formation that would require you know, pretty expensive wells and completions to produce. So there is no construction activity going on there this winter as we thought it might be earlier. They're also conducting a very ambitious exploration program about halfway over to Barrow in the Smith Bay area. So Smith Bay, they're drilling the second of two exploration wells there. They should be wrapping that up shortly. Those are being drilled from very shallow water ice pads in just a few feet of water, single digits of feet of water there. So, again, a very ambitious project. We wish them well. ConocoPhillips, they run a few different units. The Colville River unit, first of all, here is they brought on the CD5 drill site, which is actually just across the river in NPRA. That had first production brought on in October last year. They have a plan for a total of 8 new wells there at the CD5 in the Colville River unit in 2016. The Greater Moose's Tooth unit, this is fully within federal lands of NPRA. They've approved $900 million in development there for a GMT-1 phase project. They also plan to drill two exploration wells. They're Timiak wells in the western part of the unit, which I'm sure they're busy on at this moment. Also, continuing on to slide 8 here, ConocoPhillips, as the operator at the Park River unit, they've brought on a couple of new areas here recently, including drill site 2S in the Kaparik field. This is an area that formerly was within the PA, but really kind of represented a hole, and they've filled that in with discovery of good producible reservoir there, confirmation of good producible reservoir, and they brought that on in October of last year as well. And then they have significant drilling planned in the current year for the Kaparik Reservoir, the Tarn Reservoir, and the West Sac Reservoir, in particular the West Sac project they refer to as the 1H News, with a number of wells that they'll be working on to bring online in the next couple of years. Looking at Exxon at Point Thompson, after a lot of false starts and things like that, we're very pleased with the progress they've made. They've completed the construction of their IPS, initial production system. This is a gas cycling project with just the few wells that they have in the reservoir. So they completed that in 2016. They've completed a 22-mile hydrocarbon liquid pipeline from Point Thompson to Padami, which then taps in to into TAPS, no pun intended. So that will be their pipeline for producing up to 10,000 or at least 10,000 barrels a day of condensate, which we expect to begin in mid-May this spring. So that's all good news. Great Bear Petroleum, they're the ones that were the first to make an aggressive stance on shale leasing in Alaska. So they're currently acquiring a large 3D seismic data set of about 450 square miles. They're not doing any drilling this year. They've told us they have plans to come back and do some additional work at a well they drilled in a previous year in 2017. And I believe that's going to be testing, but I'm not certain the extent of that additional work. Hillcorp, they're now a North Slope player. They have operatorship at North Star, where they've returned a couple of wells to production, and they're moving along with that development. Milne Point unit also, they've drilled 3 new wells. They've started construction of a new grind and inject facility last year, and they plan to drill 10 new wells and complete 16 workovers in the present calendar year. Repsol and Armstrong at the Pikka unit, the Nanushik project development, I'm sure most of you have probably heard of that project. It's a very exciting project that is right now in the environmental impact statement or study phase under the National Environmental Policy Act. So they began that last June. We expect it to be wrapped up in several years, but it's currently undergoing scoping and public comment, and that's where Director Feige is right now, is at some of those meetings in Fairbanks. So just last year, they drilled 3 more exploration wells with a sidetrack, and in the Pikka unit leases, they've drilled a total of 12 wells and sidetracks since 2012. So they're to be commended on their rate of exploration. And they do plan to drill one additional well to confirm some of those discoveries next year, not this year. So looking at the North Slope in terms of the wells drilled and the amount of seismic acquired, this is about a 10-year period here, 2004 to 14. About 110 exploration wells and well branches, so those would be sidetracks. And over 1,600 development wells and service wells and well branches. So an awful lot of development drilling. It's always more so than the exploration wells. But good steady activity over the last decade or so. For seismic data, and this is data that we had statistics for that have received tax credits in the same time period, about 870 line miles of 2D, two-dimensional seismic, and about 9,945 square miles of 3D seismic. And that's all collected. Both of those are being collected using onshore acquisition parameters, either on the tundra during the wintertime or on frozen ice adjacent to the shoreline. This does not include any exploration out in the OCS, which would be presumably mostly conducted from marine seismic vessels. So who's working the North Slope? And here we've broken this into three categories. On this slide, number 11, you see the largest companies, which we've put in a bucket of basically more than about $40 billion in market capitalization. A mid-size category, large independents and mid-size companies, and then the next slide will show a whole host of smaller companies. So I think everyone's familiar with the large majors, BP, Chevron, Conoco. Eni is the Italian state oil company, I believe, certainly Italian. Exxon and Shell. As far as large independents and mid-sized companies, Armstrong is one of the most notable there with their pairing with Repsol, who's also on this list. Anadarko has been present on the slope for some time. BG Alaska is now actually consumed by Shell, but I believe they're still maintaining their leases under the BG name as opposed to Shell. We spoke about Kaylis and their activity. Halliburton actually had joined in with Great Bear to explore in the shale play, and they contributed to the drilling of one or two wells there. Then we mentioned Hillcorp also as a North Slope player now. And then moving on to slide 12, as I say, a whole host of small independents. Seven or eight of these, I think, are actively exploring on the North Slope or have in recent years. The most of these are really more sort of leaseholders waiting for things to happen, so to speak, as opposed to actually leading the exploration of their leases.
Sure.
Representative Guerra.
Just quickly, so Repsol, I saw they started drilling or started drilling wells in 2012, and then Eni, I remember coming up around the same time, but I didn't see you list anything, so there are a lot of companies here, but you didn't list them as having any activity.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the activity slides are not necessarily entirely comprehensive. You're right. We didn't mention ENI's continuing development at Nikaichuk, but they are actively expanding PA there right now, and they're doing what would it be called? I guess prudent operator work. Yes. So, very good.
Continue.
So, just a few words about leasing trends. As I mentioned on the locator map slide, we have three area-wide lease sales in Arctic Alaska: the North Slope area-wide area, the Beaufort Sea area-wide, and the Foothills area-wide. And so we conveniently hold these areas open for area-wide leasing, basically all open tracts, unless there's some that need to be deferred for some various reasons. But basically everything that's open comes up for lease every year. And this is slide 13 showing statistics on the North Slope area-wide sales, sort of that central core area of the North Slope, from 98 through last November. So a couple of things to notice here are pretty aggressive leasing activity last year. That was a big year. A lot of that, I think there are 212. Let's see, I have a couple of notes. Last year, Kaylis put in bids for over 100 leases along the Barrow-Arch coastline and near shore, east of the Dalton Highway over to Point Thompson. And then Armstrong also bought an awful lot of leases, just about 100 leases in that same lease sale. So last year was a big year. There are a few other vagaries there. If you have any questions, I can certainly elucidate on those. But in the interest of time, I'm prepared to move on.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the leases and just generally, now are they required in a certain amount of time to do anything? Can they just sit on them and pay some kind of fee every year to hold on to them? Probably what is there?
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there are some leases that have been issued that have certain work commitments where they do have to maintain a schedule of certain expenditures and meet certain expenditure hurdles. But that's the exception. For the most part, our leasehold in Alaska is for a fixed term, whether that's 5, 7, or 10 years. And once they pay their lease bonus bid, there is an annual rental fee that they pay to the state each year. And in many cases, those escalate substantially over, you know, after a few years, giving them some incentive, I guess you'd say, to either develop or drop the leases.
Thank you.
So moving on, I think.
Continue, Mr. Decker.
Thank you, sir. Moving on to the Beaufort Sea area-wide sale. Again, this is, I think those lease sales started in 2000, so 2000 through 2015. A notable couple of years there. 2006 was a big year for leasing in that near offshore zone. About 30 tracts went up for lease, or actually were high bid in the Smith Bay in 2006, and another 20 in the Prudhoe Bay area and east of Prudhoe Bay over towards Liberty and Badami and Point Thompson. So that was a pretty aggressive year. And then 2011 had, again, more leasing in the Smith Bay area where Kalis is drilling right now, and some large acreage positions taken by Shell and by Repsol, a smaller lease position by Repsol in Harrison Bay, just west of and just offshore from the Colville River unit adjacent to NPRA. So that's kind of an intriguing pattern there. And then as far as the foothills area-wide, really there's been a lot of not very much happening in the last few decades. The 2001-2002 time frame saw a burst of enthusiasm that coincided with interest in natural gas potential in the foothills when the producers began to get and talk seriously about a North Slope gas line. Of course, that project didn't go very far at that time. Then again, in 2006, I believe that coincides with the next phase of interest in the gas line with AGEA. And really, I think since then, people have just said, well, I think we'll wait for a little bit more progress on a gas line. But the foothills is known to be a very gas-prone area, not particularly oil-prone. So its fortunes are closely linked to activity on a gas line. Moving on, if everyone's ready, we'll move to Cook Inlet. This is just a map showing where the U.S. Geological Survey has assessed the resources there and tabulating the resources here. And again, these federal estimates are the undiscovered, technically recoverable resource, not reserves, not necessarily commercial, not yet discovered. So they put about 600 million barrels of mean conventional oil in that category in Cook Inlet. So these would be the same kinds of fields that have produced oil in the basin before, conventional sandstone reservoirs. About nearly 14 trillion cubic feet of conventional gas, again, very much like the currently producing gas fields we've had there for a few decades. And then about 5 trillion cubic feet in the unconventional gas categories. These would be tight gas sandstones, lower porosity, lower permeability that would need aggressive completions and fracture stimulations and things. Also in that category would be coal bed methane. That's all good. Okay, natural gas reserves. These are estimates that my group put out within the Division of Oil and Gas last year. We believe we have about 1.18 trillion cubic feet of proved and probable, so commercial remaining reserves in our North Slope or in our Cook Inlet reservoirs. I beg your pardon. And in addition to that, there's also about 1.2 trillion additional mean resource assessed in the outer continental shelf waters south of the state area-wide lease sales. So this would be in the federal waters of Lower Cook Inlet. That's assessed by the federal government.
And Mr. Decker, Representative Pruitt has a question.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, seeing those numbers, my question is related to, of course, from the Anchorage area, what should we expect in terms of gas into the future? And could you tell me how much have we produced over the last 40 years out of, I mean, you don't give me the exact, but out of Cook Inlet? It may help me understand whether or not, you know, 13 TCF is talking about a 10-year utilization, or if we're talking about we've still got some great opportunities there.
Right. So through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I believe it's a correct statement that it's been about 8 trillion cubic feet produced to date in Cook Inlet reservoirs. So this 1.18 remaining potential or remaining proved and probable reserve is still a significant fraction of the gas available. And interestingly, that number has not dropped very much. In fact, it's actually a little bit higher than our previous reserve estimate of 2010 vintage. So what we're seeing here is the reserves growth with activity, with exploration, with aggressive development. Companies are able to book additional reserves. It's been there the whole time. It's just that they're able to contact that and book those additional reserves. So that's a number that it's not just a static number that dwindles through time. So I'm pretty encouraged that we still have a significant lifespan of resource. It all does depend on the rate of investment in getting it out of the ground. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue, Mr. Decker.
Moving on, let's look at what some of the companies are doing in Cook Inlet. Again, this is just alphabetical, the listing. Apache Alaska, we've just learned recently that they are planning to cease their activities in Alaska for now, put it on hold due to low prices. So they're putting their seismic acquisition on suspension and other exploration activity. You know, they'd been hoping to develop prospects that they could drill in the next couple of years. We probably won't see that unless prices rebound. But they do intend to hold their leases until they expire. They do intend to maintain a skeleton crew in the Anchorage office, maintaining their assets. Conoco has sort of been exiting the basin gradually over time. They took another step in that direction recently by arranging to sell the balance of their interest in the Beluga River unit. And they sold that to Chugach Electric and MLNP. So MLNP is increasing their share that they already owned. They'll be the dominant owner there at Beluga. Chugach Electric will have about 10%, and Hillcorp will continue operating, or will become the operator at about a 33% or one-third interest there. Fury Operating Alaska, they are notable for the exploration and development that's gone on in the last several years, a number of years, at the Kitchen Lights area. So they made great progress. Finally, last year, they were able to set a monopod production platform, and they do have one well hooked up and producing there. Right now, they're selling gas to Homer Electric from that one well. They have plans to drill some more wells coming up here in the next year. They've brought a new jackup rig to the basin. This is called the Randolph Yost jackup rig. It arrived in Homer less than a month ago, and they do plan to use that well to drill more development wells by cantilevering over their monopod platform. So that's good that they're on production there after several years of exploration. Bluecrest, this is at the Cosmopolitan unit. They also plan to bring a new rig in, but this is a land-based drill rig that they're going to use for long departure wells to drill into the oil pool at Cosmopolitan this year. They hope to see first oil by mid-year. We'll see if that stays on schedule. And again, that oil production will be done from onshore with long-reach wells reaching out into the offshore reservoir. But there's now been some gas exploration from a jackup rig there. They drilled the Cosmopolitan State Number 1. I guess that was Buccaneer that drilled that well. And now Bluecrest and Westpac are interested in developing that gas accumulation from offshore. So that would involve using the Spartan 151 or possibly the Randolph Yost jackup and drilling wells offshore that would be then developed for gas through a monopod platform, much like Fury is using.
Mr. Decker, Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when we're starting to look at tax credits and you're looking at the different levels, whether they're still exploring or whether they're getting to development, when they're filing their plans with you on these different levels, do you know when or if they may be using the potential tax credits as like part of their bank loan so that as we look at what does and doesn't work, is there some kind of line between the difference between I'm still exploring to where I'm not exploring it anymore and I've started the development stage and I'm actually in a different type of tax credit?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, there are different kinds of tax credits. But in Cook Inlet, my belief, and certainly DOR can correct me if I misstate this, my belief is that most of the credits that have been used have applied to both exploration and development, and those have been the 023L well lease expenditure credits, if I'm correct. And back to the first part of your question, as I understood it, yes, quite a lot of these companies are pretty dependent on getting timely reimbursements from the credits in order to roll that into the next phase of exploration or development.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So I'm assuming they file some kind of plan with DNR as they go through these different processes. When they do that, is part of that plan, does it talk about financing? And if so, you know, that they plan on using these other tax credits, or is that just like a financial portion that they do with DOR instead?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the main plans that are submitted to the state have to do with obtaining permits to use the land, so a plan of operation in order to get the permit to go out on the lease and conduct activity. Or if it's a unitized area that's actually producing or going to production, we at Division of Oil and Gas would be tasked with overseeing their plan of development, POD. So those are the main plans that we are involved with. And sure, they sometimes talk about their financing, but that's not always applicable in either one of those scenarios. And so you could certainly ask DOR if they have additional insight about that.
Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Decker.
Moving on, this is slide 18, looking at Hillcorp's activity. So Hillcorp is the dominant operator now in the Cook Inlet Basin. They run the majority of the units. So at Cannery Loop, for example, they completed a couple of new wells last year, and they planned two new well workovers this year. At Deep Creek, they drilled a new well last year and a second planned for this coming. So they're ticking off prudent operatorship. In most cases, everything's going according to plan, continuing to invest in these fields, bringing on new reserves, booking new reserves in many of these fields that had a less assertive or less ambitious producer taking over these fields when they came up for sale a few years ago. We probably wouldn't see such you know, progress in keeping these older fields moving so well. They're doing a lot of good things, fixing broken wells and so forth. Mention here just the other units, Nanilchik, Trading Bay, again, you know, prudent operator, ambitious goals. They did purchase XTO, that was Cross Timbers at one point, an Exxon affiliate. So they purchased their assets in Southern Cook Inlet and intend to do things with that. So their spend for this year is proposed or projected to be $120 million of investment. So they're very aggressively, very ambitiously turning over the work in the fields. As far as new exploration and development wells, this is a statistic we had on hand, so we used it. Apologies for the fact that it's a different time window. This is just 2010 to 2014, and that's a number that we'd looked at because of this is kind of when the basin was perceived to possibly be in crisis, and we're looking at how much activity has it seen in the last few years and how has it recovered. So 24 exploration wells and well branches drilled in that five-year period, 65 development and service wells and well branches. And so it's continued in 2015 and ongoing in 2016 as well. Looking at seismic data, and again, these are tax credit statistics, about 725 miles of 2D seismic data. Again, that's either onshore or offshore in this case, and about 660 square miles of 3D onshore or offshore. various companies doing that. Apache did a lot of it, but certainly not all of it. Some of it's been done on speculative basis. As far as who's working the Cook Inlet, really the only large major greater than $40 billion market cap would be ConocoPhillips. And as we pointed out, they're slowly sort of pulling themselves out of the basin by handing over their assets. Mid-size independents that are most active have been Hillcorp and Apache. And I think it's fair to say that Hillcorp will continue to be active, but Apache is reining in. And a number of small independents and limited liability corps. Again, some of these are actively investing and exploring. Others are more or less just holding a lease position and waiting to see what happens. But there's certainly a trend towards more of the smaller players in the basin as it matures. So Cook Inlet area-wide lease sale results, this is from 99 to 2015. The real standout there is 2011 with 106 leases taken. That was Apache's arrival in the basin. They came in with great plans and made a huge splash. Since then, especially this year, like many of our sale areas, we've seen much reduced participation with low prices. So at this point, we can turn it over to the Frontier Basin tax credit areas if you all would like it, like to hear a brief review of that. When we talk about the Frontier Basins, sometimes it's also referred to as Middle Earth, although those two terms can be confused, they're not always interchangeable. So what I'm showing in this map are five areas, actually six circles, but five basic regions in which the so-called Frontier Basin tax credit, a form of super credit for seismic and for well drilling, could be claimed. And those are the 4355.025 A6 and A7 credits. So those are sunsetting this year, as according to existing statute. And those would have been available to companies in the Kotzebue area, the Yukon River Delta area around Emonic, the Alaska Peninsula, Copper River Basin, and the Yukon Flats and Nanana Basins. And no secret that I wouldn't normally divulge the information about who's accepted some of these credits, but there's no secret, I think, that Doyon in the Nanana Basin has taken credits for wells. They've also accepted credits for seismic operations in Yukon Flats and possibly for Nanana, I'd have to check. And then down in the Copper River Basin, Atna is hoping to use credits under these project or under the A6 and 7 credits. Hoping to use those credits to offset some of the cost of exploration that they intend to still do this year, if they can get it done in time. So as far as the resource assessments for the interior basins, this is, again, it's just sort of a simplified statewide compilation, and then the red boxes point to things that are not Cook Inlet or North Slope. So the interior basins have only been partially assessed by the feds. This is showing about 234 million barrels of oil in the Yukon Flats and Kandik Basin, and about 5.6 trillion cubic feet of gas in those same two basins. So what this leaves out is a lot of the other interior basins, Nanana, Kotzebue, Copper River, the Holitna Basin, and the Susitna Basin. Of those, my particular favorites are probably Nanana, Kotzebue, Copper River, and Susitna. The Holitna is a pretty small area. But There is oil potential, but dominantly gas potential in these basins, and I think most in industry would agree with that, although there's still hope for some oil. A lot of these areas are accessible through the exploration license program, since we don't have area-wide leasing there in the interior basins. The exploration license program of the Division of Oil and Gas supplements our leasing efforts and encourages exploration outside of known provinces. So every April, we accept proposals to conduct exploration activity outside of these existing sale areas. The DNR commissioner then may issue a notice requesting competing proposals for, you know, the general area in which we've received a solicitation. The applicant would have up to 90 days to submit their proposal, their details of what they would do for a work commitment towards exploring and developing. And if they meet their work commitments, they can then convert their their exploration license to a lease, and that's happened in a few cases. The Susitna 2, the Copper River, and the Nana Basin exploration licenses have all gone to lease from license status. So just reviewing who's doing this work, ATNA is working the Copper River Basin, the Tolsona exploration license that they're currently holding. They've reprocessed 2D seismic, and they've acquired new 2D seismic in their Tolsona area. They plan to drill the Tolsona number one gas well, gas exploration well, early this year, so sometime in the first half of the year, I would say. And that's a follow-up to the ATNA number 119 well that was drilled back in 07 and 09, 08, 09 by Rutter and Wilbanks. So it's not the same structure, but it's in the vicinity and certainly benefits from the information from previous drilling there. In the Nanana Basin, Doyon has been pretty active. They've drilled the Nunavak number 1 and number 2 wells between 2009 and 2013. They've acquired 2D and 3D seismic, gravity, magnetics data, and lake bed geochemical surveys over a series of, 10, 11 years. They did convert that exploration license to leases, and they are currently wrapping up 2D seismic exploration in the Nanana Basin and plan to spud their Togateli number one well this year in June. They're also, Doyon, moving on to slide 27, also active in the Yukon Flats Basin. No wells yet, but they've taken a good look at it through geophysics and geochemical surveys, similar to what they've acquired in the Nanana Basin. So they actually own a lot of that land themselves. That's not state land, so there would be no exploration license in the Yukon Flats. Nana Regional Corporation up in the Kotzebue Basin area, they're evaluating and marketing prospects that are based on legacy industry seismic data that they possess back from the 1970s. They've developed leads and prospects and are seeking investors to conduct either oil or gas exploration there. Usabelli Coal Mine, Inc. has drilled one shallow exploration well in 2014. They have a gas-only exploration license there in the Healy Basin area. Moving on, slide 28, looking at wells and seismic acquired in the basin. There have been seven exploration wells and well branches drilled in the interior basins in that 10-year period, 2004 through 14. Of those, I believe three wells plus sidetracks were in the Nanana Basin. We had three in the Copper River Basin and the one at Healy that I mentioned by Usabelli. As far as 2D and 3D seismic, about 1,220 line miles of 2D seismic, about 340 square miles of 3D seismic, and that would be, I believe, at Nanana, Doyon's 3D. So looking at the list of exploration licenses that are active today, we have five, the Healy Gas Only, the Nanana Basin, Southwest Cook Inlet, that's down on the Alaska, or on the Aniskan Peninsula, Southwest Cook Inlet, the Tolsona license over at Glen Allen, and Susitna 5. Now, just yesterday we learned that CIE, Cook Inlet Energy, has, as part of their bankruptcy proceedings, let us know at Division of Oil and Gas that they will be relinquishing their Susitna 5 license, which is too bad. They had an interesting place to explore there and had done some work, and I was personally eager to see the results of drilling, but I guess as a result of low prices and other factors there, we won't see that exploration on that exploration license. So I believe that actually concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Decker. Questions from committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to spare the rest of the committee, so I will strike a blow for brevity and not ask that question.
Any other questions from committee? Ms. Feige, I don't know if you're, Director Feige, I don't know if you're still online, if you'd like to make any comments. She's still online?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good evening, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Corey Feige, Director of Division of Oil and Gas. First of all, I'd like to thank Paul for doing a great job there, flying solo by himself, and my apologies for for not being there in person. Just a couple of things that I would like to point out about the slides that show the smaller companies working in both Cook Inlet and on the North Slope. It's important to recognize that the business models of those smaller companies are quite a bit different from the models of the larger players, and certainly than the majors. On both of those lists that you have before you, it's important to note that certainly on the North Slope, roughly 6 or 7 of the small companies noted on that list are actually joined together on one project. So you'll see these companies come together and partner. Several of them, as we see with the Mustang project, have, I believe, 6 or 7 partners in it that are on that list. And in Cook Inlet, Fury's efforts are actually, there's 3 or 4. There's Cornucopia, Fury operating, and the main point is that those companies bundle together in groups to, you know, spread the investment around and be able to raise the capital necessary to undertake the projects.
Any questions of Director Feige? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Decker.
Thank you,
thank you very much for your presentation. It was very interesting, kind of enlightening and encouraging. Okay, at this time I'd like to bring Mr. Alper and Commissioner back and the Commissioner back up to the table to continue with their presentation, and we'll flood them with questions.
Brief at ease to get ourselves set up.
Yes, brief at ease while we change the computer slides. All right, we're back on the record. I apologize for jumping around on the schedule tonight, Mr. Decker is very happy because he did make his plane. So he's at the airport, and he got out there in time to get his plane. So that was very good. Okay, we're going to return to Mr. Alper and the commissioner and let them continue with their presentation, and we'll ask some questions. Gentlemen, place yourselves back on the record, and thank you for your indulgence in hanging around with us. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Ken Alper. I'm the director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue.
And for the record, I'm Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
Where we left was on slide 55. There are only three more substantive slides in the presentation, talking about how we're going to implement the changes envisioned in House Bill 247. Looking at the transition, as originally presented to the body, we suggested an effective date of July 1st of this year, the beginning of fiscal year 17 for most of the changes. The committee substitute before you moved most of the changes to January 1st, so 6 months later, with the full repeal of the well-lease expenditure, the elimination of that 40% credit ramps down by January 1st of 2018. In the original version of the bill, there was a fiscal note for a fund capitalization in the amount of $926 million in change. That seems like an unusually precise number. The reason for that is the operating budget that's currently both versions of it in the conference committee contains an appropriation to the tax credit fund of exactly $73,425,000, so which is a statutory formula tied back to some old rules over how the tax credit fund was originally intended to be funded. So the governor put $73 million in the budget. With the passage of this bill, we envisioned bumping that up to a full $1 billion, a round $1 billion, that being enough to clear the decks, more or less, to pay all the pending tax credits, everything that's in the pipeline right now, up through the effective date of the bill. So that was the original thought. With the changes made in the committee substitute, among other things, the expected ongoing tax credit liability is quite a bit higher than was as envisioned in the original bill. If that were the case, we would eventually need some additional appropriation beyond that 926 that would get us through all of FY17 and only partway into FY18. The previous committee also turned all of the fiscal notes into indeterminate numbers, so that fund cap is no longer before you, and we did not bring it forward because it did not seem necessary for the bill as it's currently written. The bill as it's currently written is basically a scaled-down version of the current system, and we need to find a mechanism to fund FY17 credits in the one of the budget bills before the body right now. Important to put this bill in context. When we were in the first committees of referral, the initial hearings on all of the governor's bill tried to put the bills in the context of each other. This bill, 247, was one of 10 bills that comprised the governor's overall fiscal plan, then being the Permanent Fund Protection Act, the income tax bill, the aid loan bill, this bill, the three consumption tax bills, alcohol, tobacco, and motor fuel, and the three business tax bills, mining, fisheries, and the cruise ship head tax. So those bills taken together, as well as the anticipated budget cuts over a couple of years, proposed a balanced budget that would be in place by FY19, at least as of the numbers in the spring revenue in last fall's revenue forecast. More importantly, the broader fiscal package, including the specific tax credit bill and the changes that were proposed, were intended to add some certainty for industry regarding what the state government could actually afford and pay for, and how we're going to continue to pay for government going forward. We wanted to create a stable situation, and still do. Also, the original bill, the tax credit bill, was in many ways introduced with a companion measure. They were not necessarily codependent on each other, but they were thought of as being implemented together, a loan program through ADA, the Alaska Economic Development, and what's the E stand for, Mr. Chairman?
ADA.
Right, agency, to help with projects that might be losing funding with the credit changes. You have that bill in this committee. It's House Bill. Actually, it might be in another committee, House Bill 246. House Bill 246 would create a new fourth fund at ADA, in addition to the revolving loan, Arctic infrastructure, and sustainable energy funds, to concentrate really on just oil and gas development loans, specifically for proven reserves. There was no desire or interest in having ADA be in the high-risk exploration funding business, but once someone gets their project to where you know there's a resource there, the thought was ADA could be involved in the direct lending business and possibly with some long-term loans that don't need to get paid back until there's actual production and revenue coming out of the ground. So that bill is remains before the body. And there was expected, alongside the $900 million fund cap that we proposed for this bill, an initial $200 million in fund capitalization that would go to the new ADA loan fund. So, Mr. Chairman, from talking to my own staff and people who have met with members of the committee, I know there was some interest in that ADA fund. If there are any questions, I might want to pause now just because this is the only reference to it in the presentation.
Any questions? Ready? I don't see any, Mr. Alford.
Easy as pie, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sather has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, just generally, I suppose I could really give us some idea of what the criteria are going to be for loans from that ADA, whatever the fourth fund is going to be for development.
Do you want to take the first crack? Sure. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, I'm by no means the expert on this piece of legislation. Mr. Springsteen from ADA has presented it in before one or another committees. But it is the key thing is that it's a loan of up to, I believe, 50% of a project value. There needs to be some sort of proven reserve. There needs to be a resource evaluation and some sort of external consulting services that would be obtained by ADA to make sure that this was a legitimate project, that the cost of those services would somehow be rolled into the loan itself, so they would be paid back. There are some technical changes made to the other three ADA funds, and beyond that, I'm a little bit beyond my depth, and I can't give you that much more.
Probe
that. So this would have to be a loan that is a development. It's a proven reserve has to be there, so this would be towards development and production?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, yes. The idea is that to the extent we're still providing credits, those credits could still be focusing on exploration work, but we shouldn't be lending money that's not going to – against a project that might not be able to pay it back. So this is, it's truly a revolving loan. The expectation is once companies started paying it back, that money would be used to fund new projects. Obviously, if you don't know that there's going to be production, you can't make a loan like that.
Thank you. Representative Sadler had a follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Helper. Thank you. To the chair, you had said up to 50% of the project value. Just want to make sure you mean project costs. Or
thank you, Representative Sadler. I mean that through the chair, good, project cost.
Good, thanks.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bullet says the original bill had assumed an assumption, a companion bill, with an ADA loan. So we're talking about two versions of the bill right now. So what has that evolved into? And with the current version that came out of resources, how relevant is this to that version, this concept, the ADA loan concept?
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it would be less relevant because the intent was that it would replace some of the cash credits with a loan program. Certainly, a lot of those credits are being used to leverage loan money for the projects, and so this would be more of a direct loaning situation at rates that would be at least as competitive, if not at least as competitive as what could be in the market, and probably at a rate that's better than they're going to get with venture capital or private equity money. And the other is that we have the option of patient capital. We could actually set it up so that we would not start requesting repayment on the debt until there was actual production, which, again, is a benefit to the developer. But it's not totally irrelevant, even under this package, because we would still like to see people move towards that that loan program versus direct credits. And there was provisions, at least initially, in that credit bill, that if they took the credits, then they would no longer be eligible for the loans. Took the loans, they'd be no longer be eligible for the credits. So,
follow up, Representative Guttenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the original bill had the loans. The loans, and now we've gone back to direct credits.
Ken Alper again, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. The original House Bill 247 did not directly reference the loan program. They were introduced as something of a package. The idea is that the original bill greatly reduced the expected credit support, and therefore there would be need for this new loan program.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't finished with my question, but thank you for jumping on that. So I'm just thinking about the fiscal, the difference between a loan package and a direct payout. I mean, there's no return to the state with the direct payout, but the loan package become a revolving loan fund. I'm just thinking about in context of the fiscal situation that the state's in. Could you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, could you comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, I'm not exactly sure of the context of the question, but we did see this as a long-term solution. That with the revolving loan fund, it would have to be endowed originally. There may have to be some additional appropriations somewhere along the line, depending how popular the program became. But that eventually the capital would return and it could be reloaned. Whereas, of course, obviously with a direct cash payouts, it's once they're out the door, they're out the door, and you have to continually appropriate for it.
And we are debating House Bill 247. This is delving into House Bill 246, which we don't have before us right now. Representative Guttenberg.
Well, I guess we're talking about the evolution of the bills and the relevance of going back to a direct credit, and wondering about the solvency of the state in the context of money going out the door with no return on it, which is my concern of a lot of these credits, where they're going out the door, economic analysis out into the future, it's always red. It never turns black. And the difference between giving money away for something that there's no return on and a loan program, I guess maybe we'll get into the difference of comparing the two bills or maybe a CS and figure out what that is. But, Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, it's a bullet up there. It's relevant to all of the bills. I guess I don't see why we couldn't ask the question, but I'm concerned about the solvency of the state and the difference between credits just going out the door and having a revolving loan fund to compare two versions of the bill and the health, economic health of the state. But that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gary. Your mic's close. I assume you're wanting to ask a question.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, this is all hard to take in really quickly, but it's a big issue. So let me take my best attempt at trying to understand a few things. Let me know where I'm wrong and where I'm right. In Cook Inlet, the governor's intention was to allow the net operating loss to continue for companies that don't make money, to encourage them to explore, but to eliminate for companies that are making a profit the capital expenditure credit, the well lease expenditure credit, on the ground that those companies aren't paying production taxes, we shouldn't be paying credits. So credits to those companies that are not making money, no credits to those companies that are making money. Was that the theory in Coconut?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, the one part that I might correct is that not so much to encourage them to explore, but also to support them while they were under development. The net operating loss credit would, as originally proposed, we would be paying 25% or refunding 25% of a company's costs up until the point that they were in production and profitable.
Through the chair.
So,
but the dividing line essentially then is, and thanks for correcting me, the dividing line essentially is for companies that are doing work but not making money, they get supported by a credit in Cook Inlet, but for companies that are producing and not really paying any production taxes in Cook Inlet, their credits, the capital credit and the well lease expenditure credit, those would disappear. Is that the idea?
Through the chair, to be clear, Representative Garrett, that was the bill as originally proposed, what you're describing. Yes.
Okay.
So
I understand that. The other provision that the governor had proposed was to limit the annual credit payments of the remaining credits. You would limit them to $25 million instead of $200 million, which is in the resources version, per per participant, I guess. Is that correct?
Through the chair, per company per year, yes. And current statute is without a limit. The $25 million was an amendment to that. The committee substitute is the $200 million figure.
I'm through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
So just to understand the essentials of the governor's proposal, then the other proposal was to have a hard minimum tax floor for those fields that pay the minimum tax. So there's right now there's no minimum tax for GVR fields, right? But for the pre-2000 fields, you would have a hard floor and you wouldn't let somebody use the net operating loss to take them below that tax floor. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett. Yeah, thank you. Yes, you just said two different things, and they're both more or less correct. For the new oil that enjoys the gross value reduction, who currently can pay at zero, we are intending to create the floor for them and make them pay at the floor level. For the older, the legacy fields who do pay at the floor, we want to, what the word we've used is harden the floor so that an operating loss credit can't reduce payments to below the floor. Yes.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
So that's really the third piece, other than the ADA loan, which I'll ask a question about. But that's really the third piece of your plan is, no more, I guess, no more 0% tax GVR oil. They'll also be, the floor would also apply to them, and the floor would be hardened, so you can't use the net operating loss credit to go below that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, those are certainly the major provisions of the bill. There's a lot of smaller bells and whistles in there, but yeah, you've got the high points, absolutely. Thank you.
And then just,
Representative Garrett.
And then what is there envisioned whether there's a cap or what it would cost us to do the ADA loan part? Other than capitalizing ADA at one time, is it just a one-time capitalization of ADA, or is there an ongoing cost to the state for that part of the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, and I can't speak with certitude about any fiscal notes attached to another bill, but I do not believe they added any ongoing cost for themselves. The bill in question 246 creates statutory authority for a new fund with a little bit separate management and a fourth parallel structure inside the governing ADA law, and then the fiscal note attached to it would put that initial $200 million in there with the expectation that would at least get them going to start making some loans.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And then just, I guess, one other question. You came out with a projection if we don't change the law under existing law, what we're going to get in rough production taxes over the next few years. Can you tell us, if we don't change the law, what the state net, after you deduct tax credits, what the state is projected to get in production taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, and I'm not certain I understand the question, but I'm going to try. The production taxes are quite low in the present environment and expected to go to even lower in the next couple of years. We're presuming that all the major producers will have operating losses in 2016, so that by FY17, FY18, the production tax drops to a number very close to zero. If you're saying what we're spending in the production tax, if the tax credit regime, if it's considered to be part of the tax system, we have $825 million of estimated production tax cost for FY17. That's the updated number from the spring forecast. $450 million in FY18, and I believe it's $390 or $375 in FY19.
I think I have one final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
And without a change, if I read your forecast right, without a change, production taxes will exceed, tax credit payments will exceed not just production taxes, but all of our oil revenue, including royalties, corporate taxes, property taxes. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that fact and figure has been in the paper, so I want to make sure it's very clear to all members. The number, when the governor made that, when he released the spring forecast last Monday, the revenue for unrestricted general fund of all oil and gas sources, so the production tax, the corporate income tax, the property tax, the refinery taxes and the like, conservation surcharge, and then that share of royalty that goes to the general fund, not the 25% that goes to the permanent fund, all of that adds up to a number in FY17 that's expected to be less than the anticipated credit spend. That's somewhat unique to FY17. In FY18, we're in the black again overall against the oil industry, although it's still a relatively small number. We're in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Alper, I just bear with me for a minute, so make sure I've got this straight. With the CS that we are looking at, it has a $200 million credit limit. Is that correct, per company?
Mr. Chairman, $200 million per individual company, yes.
Okay, so if we had four companies go together and work on one project on one pad, they could each get $200 million. That would be $800 million in credits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. For that to happen, of course, they would have to be spending over $2 billion in that
right.
year. But, yes, they could.
Curious about the stacking. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the governor's bill, if I recall, he was basically getting rid of the gas cook inlet tax credits. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the governor's bill got rid of what we called the QCE, or the 20% capital credit, and the WLE, or the 40% well lease expenditure credit. Those are the credits tied to expenditure that can be stacked with the operating loss credit. The operating loss credit was left intact at 25%. So for the point of view of a company that's not profitable, that's under development effectively, they're spending money, instead of their current roughly 60% level of support, they would be getting 25% from the state. And then for the company that is producing and by extension presumed to be profitable, they would not be getting any credit support from the state.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
Were any of these expenditures, was any of that in SB 21?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, SB 21 did not touch upon any of the credits outside of the North Slope at all.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So for the change, does that have to do with that at this point, because of gas and at the low price gases and the abundance of it, that at this point in time in history that this might be a time to make some step down because we found a lot of gas, Anchorage doesn't have the same issues that Fairbanks has? No, I'm sorry, but so it might be, you knew I had to. But anyway, so this might be a good time to look at those, especially since in 2022 there's a bigger step down.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the commissioner and I spoke to Senator Geisel's working group several times over the interim. I'm sorry for the convoluted answer, but I want to get to where this fact came from. We put a line on a slide, a bullet that said, maybe in Cook Inlet it's time to declare victory and move on. We got a little pushback from members of the committee for saying that, so I haven't put it in any presentations this session, but you're making a valid point. The issues of supply anxiety are somewhat less severe than they were 6 or 7 years ago, and you know, the sponsors of that legislation, the people that put in the enhanced credits for Cook Inlet, have used the expression, pulled the fire bell. Like, we're afraid of freezing in the dark here. The lights are going to go out. We're going to run out of gas. We need to do extreme measures. To a certain extent, the mission is at least partly accomplished, that we could at least talk about ramping down those credits, absolutely.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
And fiscal note that went with that portion of it, what was the savings this year to the state if just that portion of it was accepted?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe that was in the neighborhood of about $150 million in the original fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Just one request. Can you get us, and we always ask for these charts and we never get them, but I'm going to keep trying. So if we had something that you could do that would show us the tax credits that we're talking about that were in SB 21, there'd be change in those that are not, that were not in SB 21, that would be very helpful to me, especially if you made it and gave it to us.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's a nice little one piece of paper that we presented to the Joint Resources Committee hearing in Kenai back in June that I think does exactly what you're asking for, and we'll get it right to you.
Get it to my staff, Mr. Alper. I'll get it out to all the members.
Yeah, and in fact, Mr. Chairman, I believe I sent it to Jane last night, so they might already have it.
Get it out. Further questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Goodness, don't know where to start, but if we're making chart requests, Mr. Alper, go to chart 47, if you would, please.
Page 47 on your...
Yep. Yep, exactly. So through the chair, I would, again, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you. If we have been remiss in not designing a tax system that worked equally well at all possible ranges of oil prices. I would like to ask to see these same analyses at $20 per barrel, $30 per barrel, $100 per barrel, and if it's easy, $120, because it should be quickly easy to done with a computer, and who knows what can happen to the price of oil. So it might be a bit of a drill, but if you could produce those charts, that'd be great.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we can certainly do that. I just want to be clear. Are we just now talking about this Cook Inlet small field scenario, or a wider range of the other scenarios that we did as well?
Well, honestly, maybe the fairer thing to do would be to go to chart 51, page 51, where you've kind of done the summation. I don't know if we need to see the exact bar charts and everything, but you might just expand your price range to 20, 30, and 100. The summation is kind of nice.
Add 20, 30, and 100 to the 40, 60, 80 is what you're
That's correct, yes.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, absolutely. At 120, I believe, was what the representative asked for. You'll find, just as 40 is depressingly red, 20 and 30 aren't going to be a whole lot aren't going to be a whole lot worse, basically.
I'm not getting much sleep anyway, so that's on chart 47 through the chair. There was some discussion about the cap and OPEX allocations for these models. Is it the assumption that the capital expenditure of $18 per barrel, is that assumed, is that averaged over the entire 30-year life of this? For these models?
Chair, Representative Sadler, the CapEx is very front-loaded, which is why the credits tend to, I mean, we based it on some model fields that we've seen developed and known information. And any new oil field, of course, has a lot of the capital spending in those first 4, 5, 6 years. The operating, meanwhile, tends to be ongoing as the field is in production, and that's more of a per-barrel charge that goes on from year to year. And each of these sets of scenarios in the original presentation they were pulled from has a full slide of assumptions. I will make sure that we get the chair all of those presentations that show exactly what the assumptions are.
If he'd be, perhaps just one of the slides that shows all the assumptions would be helpful. And I understand about the CapEx being more at the front end of a project, but I'm not sure if that $18 per barrel, if that's an average out or that's the first 5 years, but it would be good to know that.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, thank you for asking, because what we're looking at in this specific field is a field where all of the oil produced over the entire 30-year life is going to add up to 50 million barrels of oil. That's the idea. That's what they're going to produce. So when we say $18 a barrel, 50 times 18 is $900 million. It means that the total capital spend to get this thing running is going to be $900 million, tending to be front-loaded, but with a little bit of trailing into the middle years of as the final development drilling is done.
And certainly our interest kind of is in the aggregate. That's kind of the level we're working at now. Thank you, sir. I got a couple technical questions about the stuff we've long discussed. I just want to confirm that, let's again stay on 47, that the net state gain includes, it does include royalty, property tax, production tax, and corporate income tax. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, and it's truly the state fraction. There's other state take in there, meaning there's the share of the property tax that's kept by the local government, the municipal government, that's not on that chart.
There's only so much you can put on one chart, I understand. Okay. Okay, let's see. Chart number 34. You make reference to the bill as proposed by the administration, fixes a technical error in SB 21 that prevents compound interest. Do you mean a policy? That sounds like either policy call. Why is it a technical error?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there was a series of slides that sort of walked through the legislative history of SB 21. I'll try to briefly explain it. So the original bill is proposed by Governor Parnell in 2013. The previous law said that the interest rate was 11%. And the intent of the bill was to reduce it to 3% over the federal discount rate. But previous law had compound interest, and the original version proposed by the previous administration also kept the compound interest. The bill got all the way to the Senate floor, the other body's floor, and passed with the 3% over discount rate compound interest. But you may recall that was a somewhat contentious piece of legislation, and it failed to garner an effective date vote, a two-thirds vote in the other body. Consequently, the bill came to the House Resources Committee, of which you, I believe, at the time, through the chair, President Sadler, were a co-chair, and The committee substituted, the resources committee was required to put in some workaround language to the failure to have an effective date vote in the other body. And thus there's a lot of somewhat convoluted applicability sections inside Senate Bill 21 that say, on or before January 1st, 2014, X, after January 1st, 2014, Y. And similar language was inserted into the interest rate sections. But once again, compound interest remained. There was some sort of drafting error in the Finance Committee substitute that put back this reference to an 11% rate. So the amendment that the chairman's amendment, you know, always on these big bills, there's amendment number one by the chairman that cleans up the little stuff. And that amendment eliminated the reference to the old 11% language. But tailed on to the end of it, it also eliminated the sentence compounded quarterly. Consequently, the bill passed, got concurred with, and went into law on January 14th with simple interest, when most people who have analyzed the subject believe really did not intend to do that. And the Resources Committee accepted that logic as we laid the story down to them in a somewhat more convoluted version with three or four slides, and left the compound interest in the committee substitute.
I salute you and your working brain cells at this hour. Thank you. Okay. Do we have another opportunity to ask questions of these gentlemen? Or is
they'll be back. Yes, they will. So we can have them back and dig into more
certainly
questions.
Certainly, at this hour, it's probably appropriate to bring you back. So I want to keep my last remaining friend in the committee.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, so mine's less about the slideshow and more of I guess I should ask, are you talking to your counterparts in other states, oil states like North Dakota, Texas, any place? Have you been talking to them? What are they doing right now? How are they addressing this, the downturn in oil?
The Competitive Review Board last year put out a report that looked at the tax structure within various states, and we're unique in that we're the only one that has a net tax. The rest are all on a gross tax basis. I don't know that the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board has not followed up on it for this year. I do know that there's been some provision changes in some of the other states, but I don't know them right offhand.
If I could add one thing on top of that, Ken Alper again through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the other states that produce oil in America are all on the gross. We're the only one on the net. We are also the only state that offers refundable cash credits. So companies are losing money in Oklahoma and North Dakota and Texas right now, probably because the price of oil is the same there as it is here, and they are paying a gross severance tax to those states of 4, 5, up to 11%. It varies widely from state to state. And those payments are, for the most part, paid. You know, what we have in this state, and the commissioner mentioned it last week, we really have a 4% gross tax at this price. The net tax is almost a theoretical upside thing that we have should prices recover. But that 4% gross tax is being offset by these tax credits that are putting us into what's effectively a negative position, which makes us unique among the states right now.
So effectively, though, I mean, we can't get away from it. We are increasing our tax, though. Whether you're decreasing credits, which play into it, the argument I get, where we're the only one that doesn't have a gross, we're increasing our tax by reducing our tax credit. So that being said, I guess it begs to differ. Who else out there is increasing their tax in this time where we've got low oil prices?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I think we probably have a fundamental disagreement on whether the removing of a subsidy is the increase of a tax. A tax is a demand from a government entity for a payment. In this case, we are paying money out, and we are just reducing the amount of subsidy that we're paying. This really falls into the classification of a subsidy, not a tax. And so we are reducing the subsidy, but I think we would differ on classifying as an increase in tax. It does change the bottom line to industry, but it isn't. We aren't raising the tax. We're reducing a subsidy.
No, Mr. Chair. Yeah, but this bill doesn't just address the credits. It's also trying to harden the floor. It's as not only harden the floor, but increase the floor from 4 to 5%. So we essentially, I mean, I go back to the same point. We essentially are increasing. Is there anyone else that's increasing the tax in this environment?
Yeah. through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I will stand corrected on the hardening of the floor and the 4 to 5%. That is definitely an increase in tax. At this point in time, no, I don't believe anybody else is increasing taxes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Looks like we're going to be finished for the evening.
I have one more slide, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, we have one more slide. Slide 58.
58. And this is just this is the easy part. This is what we're going to do to make it all happen. Here at the Department of Revenue, we, as you know, Mr. Chairman, we have over the last few years built an extensive and comprehensive tax management system, tax revenue management system, that the legislature funded back in 2011 with $34.7 million in capital appropriations. We thank you again. It has been a remarkable generational game changer for the Department of Revenue. We're electronic, we're integrated, our reporting capacity, it's been a very successful software package for the state. That said, it now requires reprogramming every time you change something. And this is inevitably going to be a somewhat substantial reprogramming of the tax paying system, of the data, the data handling system, and also a substantial testing burden on our own people. We put out to our contractor, what's it going to cost to get all these changes made? It's going to take about a year, and they tell us we could do it. You know, we put $1.2 million in the fiscal note to cover changes to the system one time to make the changes proposed in this bill, some of which will impact every single tax type. Specifically, to follow up on what we were just talking about, to Representative Sadler's question, compound interest is in the master tax statutes. It affects all 25 of our taxes. And as we go back to compound interest, we're going to need to make a little bit of a change and test it in all 25 of our taxes. However, once we've done that, we are not going to increase our staff or desire any additional resources to administer the tax and credit program. And of course, we're going to have a little bit of a robust regulatory project this summer, should the bill pass this year, next fall, hoping to have all the regs in place by January 1st. And now, Mr. Chairman, I really am done.
All right. With that, we will now set House Bill 247 aside. I want to thank Director Alper and Commissioner Hoffbeck very much for your presentation today, and we will be having you back because I know there's going to be additional questions. If any committee members have additional questions that we can get answered for you, get those to my staff. Jane will be able to get after that and get answers back and pass out the question and answers to all the committee members. Representative Garrett.
Can I just ask this question to get to add to the packet? I know there's a statutory formula for what we're required to pay in all tax credits under the current law. Certainly we're allowed to pay more if we want, but could you just get us the calculation of what the statute says we're required to pay?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. All right. The next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Friday, April 1st, 2016 at 1:30 p.m., and at that time, we will hear HB 247 again. We'll have industry testimony, Alaska Oil and Gas Association, AOGA, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, BP, Hillcorp, and Kalis Energy Alaska. And that is tomorrow at 1:30, and then tomorrow at 5 p.m., we're going to have Analytica come in and make a presentation for us. So with that, at 7:20 p.m., we are adjourned.